just have the judiciary come to order. I have 1:35 on the afternoon of Friday, April 15th, tax day. I just realized. Unfortunately.
Monday.
The new Monday, that's right, for all those who are listening and watching. We have a quorum to conduct business. Senator Pascan is here. Senator Wilikowski is walking in the room. Senator Coghill is here. Myself, Senator French. We have three matters in front of the committee today. We'll begin with SB 89, Senator Coghill's bill on legislative ethics. Then we'll go to SB 98, biometric information by Senator Wilikowski. SB 104, by me, manufactured homes. Maybe you've detected the theme that we're hearing bills by us today. So it's all about the Judiciary Committee. And I see Ms. Moss is here. Welcome to the committee. Senator Coghill, you can present your bill in any manner you see fit.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thanks for hearing the bill. And the ethics bill, Senate Bill 89, that's before you, has been a work in progress that kind of ended up in my hands to be a task leader on. So there are several things that the task has asked us to do. And what I'd like to do is I'd like to ask my chief of staff, Reneva Moss, to go through and show you the section by section. I know that I think three of us heard this bill in the state affairs. It's been amended. This is the version T version that took some of the more contentious issues out. What I'd like to do is go through the bill as it is, and then I have an amendment that I would like to speak to, showing that I heard some of the questions coming up from the last committee. I think I have some good answers, and I'd like to throw them on the table for discussion. Great. So with that, I'd like to have Ms. Moss go through the version T for us.
Reneva Moss, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, Reneva Moss, staff to Senator Coghill. I'm just going to go through section by section. Section 1 takes up three pages, but actually the only changes are on page 2. To make it consistent with 2460.080, we have changed lawful gratuity to gift, and we have inserted reference to AS 2460.075, which is the compassionate gift statute that was passed a couple years ago dealing with Representative Foster. Section 2 is an attempt to draw a very bright line for legislators and staff in dealing with constituents. This says that once a matter goes before an administrative hearing officer, unless the legislator is licensed to practice law, the legislative office will sever any assistance they have been given to the constituent. And it also allows for inadvertent ex parte contact, because as you know, there are times when constituents call you and they don't tell you it's before an administrative hearing officer. You contact the department, and that's illegal, but it's not knowingly doing it. So there is an exception there.
Let's stop just there for a second, if you would. And I'll just apologize to everyone. I think the other three members here have all heard this bill, but I have not. And so just refresh my recollection. For example, the initial denial of a permanent fund dividend for a common issue. If I write a letter saying, hey, please look at my constituents' permanent fund situation, make sure it got a thorough and fair review. Mm-hmm. Am I writing to the administrative hearing officer on that first level, or am I just writing to some state?
Mr. Chairman, the first level is what they call an informal denial. So you can communicate with the department at that stage, but once it goes to a formal denial and a request for an administrative hearing, then your office would have to back off.
Sure. And can you give me just maybe one or two other examples from our, like OCS actions, child placement actions, where it is okay for us to act and then somewhere we're not okay to act?
Mr. Chairman, OCS has worked with legislative offices all during the process, even though it is actually a court case. And they have a legislative liaison that legislative offices can contact directly. One example would be workers' comp. Once it comes to the point of having administrative hearings, the legislative office would have to back away from that. I'm sure there's issues with child support. that we've dealt with that once it gets beyond, I think we've helped file hardship cases, but once it goes to the point of actually requesting an administrative hearing, then we're no longer involved.
Now that, Senator Coghill,
I'll give you a little bit of background on this. These ethics laws were written before we actually had administrative law judges. And so quite often, and Reneva mentioned the workers' comp issues, we helped probably over a period of 2 years somebody who just was wrong, but they were very difficult to deal with. And so we helped them get paperwork and everything. And we had an ethics complaint filed against us because we were doing what they considered legal work. So, and we actually had an opinion saying that we had gone too far. So we were trying to help this person who couldn't get an honest-to-goodness hearing because of their personality. It was just, they were very difficult to deal with. And so then the ethics committee said 10 hours is all you can do.
I remember that.
And we said, no, there's got to be a better way. And this is really an attempt to get that better way. Mm-hmm. Now, they backed off the 10 hours, but they're looking for a statutory solution that says there's a reasonable place. So when it goes before now, what we have administrative law judges, we have administrative hearings in several different agencies. Mm-hmm. Once it gets to that decision point, then it's wrong for us to influence the decision maker. It's right for us to help them up to that decision point, but wrong for us to put pressure on the decision maker.
And Ms. Moss's reminder that just about every, I don't think there's a single department now that doesn't have a legislative liaison. Is that like a safe place for us to send our complaints if we're unhappy about the way our constituents are being treated? Can you address it to the legislative liaison and just say, look, this person is not being treated fairly by the system?
Mr. Chairman, I don't have an answer to that, and I don't think it's in statute. But as I said, the biggest problem is when the constituent doesn't tell you where they are in the process. Legislative liaisons are the first people that I contact because if I don't know who to go to directly, they do. But as far as a protection under law, I don't think there is one.
And final question from me. The 10-hour provision, was that ever in statute or was that in, like an ethics opinion?
It was an opinion, Mr. Chairman.
And does this supersede that then?
Yes.
Okay. Thank you. Please proceed. Okay. Senator Wilikowski.
So in the workers' comp example, if you have a constituent who comes to you and says, my case has been going on for 2 years, the way I read this, you could call the director of the department or a deputy director or someone and say, hey, can you just let me know what's going on with this case? Is that accurate?
Through the chair, Senator Wilikowski, that would be accurate, yeah.
Okay. But you would not be able to call, like, the chief of adjudications or?
Through the chair, you would be able to contact probably the worker that's handling the workers' comp case, but you would not be able to contact the hearing officer or the lawyer for the insurance company or probably the lawyer for the constituent.
But, Mr. Chairman, and the idea was to keep us from becoming free counsel, to becoming their lawyers. Unless, of course, you're a legislator who is practicing law, and then we've got that carve out in here.
Right. You're working for a client. It's unrelated really to your job as a legislator. You're just showing up trying to earn a living. Very good.
And, Mr. Chairman, just to clarify, a non-attorney can handle a workers' comp case. But the reason we chose this is once it gets to an official administrative hearing, it's really between the constituent, their lawyer, and whatever division that they're challenging.
Makes sense. Senator Wilikowski.
On a point that was made, you said could not contact the lawyer representing the employee, the injured worker. Where does it say that?
Mr. Chairman, it doesn't say that, but once it goes to a hearing officer, you have parties that are involved in that hearing, and you're not supposed to contact those parties. One of those parties would be a constituent's attorney. That would be considered, if you called the constituent's attorney, that would be considered an ex parte contact because you're not going through the court or the hearing officer.
Where does it say that? in here.
Well, I'm sorry, Mr. Chairman. Ex parte is contacting a party of a case without going through the court.
I guess I had a little different understanding.
I have a hesitance on that. My belief would be, my Senator Passman is probably the most recently practicing attorney here, or Senator Lukowski, but my belief is ex parte is between a party and the judge without the other party present. And if I'm not a party and I contact someone, we may decide it's a bad idea, but I'm not sure that's what, at least that would be my common understanding of what that phrase picks up.
That's my reading.
Senator Passman.
That's mine as well. And the purpose of that definition of ex parte is to encourage the parties to speak between themselves, but that while they're trying to work it out, they cannot ex parte, meaning singularly contact the judge without the other party's representative being there at the time. Okay. So, but again, it's to encourage contact between the parties directly.
And Mr. Chairman, this also requires you to disclose if you do have contact that is considered inappropriate.
Sure, that makes sense. But I think just so we're all clear, at least here, ex parte would be as between the legislator and the hearing officer, not between the legislator and an attorney representing the constituent.
And Mr. Chairman, part of the reason I say that is because one of the first things I do now when a constituent contacts us for help is ask them if they have an attorney.
Sure.
Because attorneys do not appreciate their clients going to a legislative
Correct.
Staff.
They want to manage the case. That makes sense. Yep.
Very good. And I just want to clarify for the listening legislators out there who are wondering if we pass this, what will be ethical and unethical. I think if a client, because what I've had constituents come to me and say, my case isn't being heard, what's going on? And then we'll contact the director or the chief of adjudications and just send them a letter, say, what's the status of the case? Oftentimes we'll get a response back, the attorney is sitting on the case for whatever reason. And then if I think if the legislator, I think it is appropriate now, and I think it will continue to be appropriate under, if we pass this, if the legislature then sends a letter to the lawyer just saying, hey, just wanted to let you know there's some concern over the length of the time of this case, I don't think that would be unethical. I don't think it's unethical under current law. I don't think this is making it unethical or illegal. And I think as a policy, sending a letter to a client's attorney saying, hey, I just want to let you know that your client is concerned about the timeliness of this and they're contacting legislators, I don't think that's appropriate. I don't think that we're making that unethical.
Mr. Chairman, me if I'm wrong. Senator Wildkowski, I think it's good to have that on the record. That makes me feel better.
And for what it's worth, Mr. Chairman, I think when we had the administrative law judge hearing talk to us, my recollection is that was true, and I'll go through and check the hearing level. That was 2 years ago, I think, that we had that discussion. So, but in abundance of caution, I can tell you we are very reluctant to move forward because this is not law yet.
Right.
And so just to give my chief of staff a little cover, I've, in my office, had an abundance of caution since we wandered out in this area probably further than we should have and pulled back. So we're operating under this statute is not yet in force, so we're now under a huge abundance of caution.
Sure.
So just to let you know the difference between what we're trying to do and what we've been doing.
Sure. And just while we're at a pause, let the committee know that Joyce Anderson, our legislative ethics guru, is on the line.
The guru.
Mr. Chairman, Section 3 actually releases the Ethics Committee from having to compile statements of disclosure forms. They must keep the forms on record, available to the public, but they no longer have to compile lists of reports that were filed. Section 4 adds public members of the committee to the statute that prohibits disclosure of confidential information. Section 5 and Section 7 We were trying to make it clear in the law addressing lobbyists and charitable tickets. So we just reworded those two sections to make it very clear that you cannot accept a charitable ticket or a ticket to a charitable event that is valued more than $249.99 from a lobbyist. And that's what those two sections do.
But Mr. Chairman, it also allows you to accept a charitable gift beyond that from somebody else, and it needs to be reported.
Correct.
So not a lobbyist are excluded from above that limit, but there are people that can give beyond that limit, and it has to be a sanctioned event, and it has to be reported.
That's correct. And Section 7, Mr. Chairman, changes the reporting requirements from 30 days to 60 days for charitable gifts and for gifts of travel for the purposes of gaining legislative information.
Does this change what a lobbyist may offer to a legislator, separate from what the lobby or what the legislator can receive?
Mr. Chairman, I'm not sure I understand the question.
Mr. Chairman, I do understand the question. The answer is no. This just changes charitable events that were specifically talked about in the statute, and the wording did have some lack of clarity. And the request here is to try to figure out ways to allow a charitable event donation beyond lobbyists, non-lobbyists. For example, I think we had one event where somebody had a kidney that was in need of donation, and the dollar value problem was a question, and they were a non-lobbyist who was willing to do it, but there was an ethical question that went over it. And we're trying to answer, saying, no, you can give that. So this is really a charitable gift only. It has nothing to do with what a lobbyist can do or can't do with a as far as donations. I think we're still limited to the meal level, the prohibition on gifts and things like that. So that is not even in this discussion.
It is, while we're here, it is a little confusing to think about tickets to a charity event. You know, I think we know that those are legislative skits and so forth, but I guess it could be any charity ball, you know, the mayor's charity ball, $100 tickets. But gifts in conjunction with that, is this separate from the general gift prohibition, or is this?
Mr. Chairman, that addresses, let's say you're given a ticket to a charitable event, and these charitable events have to be sanctioned by Ledge Council. You're given a ticket to a charitable event. It is deposited in a drawing for door prizes. You can accept those gifts.
Mr. Chairman, we have that Thanksgiving in March.
Sure, March, yeah.
And the question came up over if you won that cruise, how would that look?
Ah, okay.
And then there was one other event that came up. I think one of the representatives had championed a particular issue. I can't remember if it was March of Dimes or something. They were given a gift to sit at the head table, which was like $400, by a non-lobbyist. It was actually by the group itself, mm-hmm. because that particular person was their champion. Mm-hmm. But it had an ethical complaint put against it. But there was no real ethical problem there. Mm-hmm. It was just that they wanted that person to sit at the head table, and it was a sanctioned event. So beyond a sanctioned event, I think you might have some trouble. And so I think that's why Ledge Council should oversee some of these things.
Thank you.
Section 8, this section allows for certain persons to be allowed to request a waiver from disclosing clients or making any disclosures that would violate state or federal law, the state or U.S. Constitution. And in state affairs, the language was added on page 10, lines 17 through 18, or a rule adopted formally by a trade or profession that state or federal law requires the person to follow. So it allows certain occupations not to have to disclose their sources of income from clients.
This is an ethics disclosure or an APOC disclosure or both?
This is an ethics disclosure.
APOC we deal with separately. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, It comes from also close economic association that you have to file. And under HIPAA, there are some restrictions on confidentiality. So I think there was some concern that if somebody was working on somebody here in a healthcare situation, how that might be reported. So I think that was the two issues.
Healthcare and legal.
Okay.
Section 9 and Section 13 were added in state affairs. Brought up an important issue about at what point does a volunteer have to have ethics training. Cindy was helpful in getting Michelle was helpful in getting the language for this. Basically, if a volunteer or educational trainee is in that capacity for 30 days, they would be expected to take an ethics class. Section 10 is just some housekeeping, making reference to the new statute in Section 12. And Section 11 is also the same thing. Section 12, at the end of this bill, you'll notice that we repealed 2461.30M, which was under general purposes, general provisions describing alternate members. In this bill, we have made a new section of law in Section 12 that deals with all alternate members. And what it has changed is it adds an alternate for a public member, and it allows alternates, once they have been selected to participate in a proceeding, it allows them to participate in the full proceeding to the end.
And Mr. Chairman, once again, since we were tasked to bring this bill forward, it became apparent that under the public members, quite often making a quorum for the public members was getting difficult with people from all over the state. If there was an alternate, they may be able to make a quorum, and if there was legislative business that had some urgency to it, that they would be able to put that person in. And then the question was, okay, should they step in and step out during the middle of a hearing? And the answer was, no, we think once they are engaged in that ethical question, they should maintain until the conclusion of that.
Sure.
And that would be true of both the public and the legislative members.
Great.
And then Section 14 is a change in the definition of legislative employee. The old language was a list of positions like the print shop, the supply, security, etc. And instead of changing the law every time we have a new position, what we're saying here is if they're hourly employees, then they are considered a legislative employee.
Considered not a legislative employee.
They are not required to take the ethics training.
Okay, yeah, fair enough. Yeah, that's right. Okay, good overview. Now let's get to the fun part.
Yeah, the fun part, Mr. Chairman. I actually have an amendment, and so you can see it's a pretty benign housekeeping item until I bring this amendment up.
Sure.
And, Mr. Chairman, the last committee that we heard this, I tried to explain this the best I could, but there was some interesting exchange that made me start thinking. And then I listened to a public meeting that the majority had, where several of the majority members were saying, well, we think that there is some reasonable place to discuss this. And so I listened intently. I went back to the books. I tried to think of ways to deal with this. And this is, for those who are listening in, how do we take care of people who are on state travel and allow them to be a partisan person anyhow, anyway? Is there any reasonable way to do that, knowing that generally speaking, and I'll restate it, generally speaking, most of the meetings that the legislature hold are held in either Anchorage or Fairbanks generally, outside of the Capitol when we're meeting here. And so most people outside of Anchorage have to leave their homes, leave their business, you know, and then come to Anchorage. And quite frankly, they give up a lot already to be there to do legislative business. But when they're in town, if there is a partisan event like let's just say one of their favorite campaigners is coming to town, like one of our congressional delegation comes into town, and it's a partisan event, well, those of us outside of town are prohibited to going to it, while those in town can freely do it. And so we're trying to think, how do we allow that without giving the kind of the motive that we all don't want to have, and that is for them to use state money to campaign. I mean, that is kind of the one-way valve that I keep talking about. We want them to do one thing nobly, and we don't want them to use it improperly. So what I suggested is this amendment, and so just for official, if you want, Mr. Chairman, I'd move the amendment, which is the T1. Now, I'll try to explain what I've got here.
Okay. You've moved it. I'll object, and we can discuss it.
All right. And, Mr. Chairman, I understand that this is a tough issue. We're at the end of the session. If we set this aside for the rest of the session, I will understand that there's no companion in anybody here. So this might be something you might want to lay on the table and chew on. I understand that. But what I tried to do is say there is a reason to consider this. So there's two sections of law. There's 030 and 031. 030 talks about the ethical management. 031 talks about the fundraising management of ethics. So I can't remember the exact headings. Maybe Renevo can find them for me. But 030, and if Mr. Chairman, since we have people watching, I would like to at least read, and it's the same language for both sections. Notwithstanding the limitations, that the limitations say you can't use public resources for these partisan activities. So notwithstanding those provisions, it says here, a legislative employee who is on state travel may participate in partisan political activity. That's the hot button question. How? Including campaign activity if. So here are the ifs. The participation is incidental to the purpose of the travel. And this was the new part that I, when I heard the discussion the other day, how do I get to incidental? And I actually, on the back of this, should have I think this is a legal definition of incidental, Mr. Chairman. Dependent upon, subordinate to, arising out of, or otherwise connected with something else of greater importance. So it's subordinate to or arising out of or otherwise connected to. Subordinate to something of greater importance, having a minor role. Okay, that's the incidental part. I was reading incident, sorry. Subordinate to something of greater importance, having a minor role. So I thought after listening to the majority talk, how do we get there? So I thought the first thing it should be, any participation should be incidental to the purpose of the travel. That puts it way under the 50%, way down at the bottom. It's quite light. And then it was not the primary use. The legislator or legislative employee does not use or authorize the use of state resources to pay for the activity. So it's not on the state nickel that you make, say, entrance to a lunch, things like that. The legislator or legislative employee does not participate in the activity under these conditions then. During a normal work day, and so I put between 8 and 5, excluding meal breaks. And I was thinking particularly of luncheons is what I had in mind. But breakfast probably would fit there as well. On a state or municipal election day, so I wanted a clean prohibition. And 30 days immediately preceding an election in which the participant, a participating legislator, or the legislator whom the participating employee works for is a candidate for office. So I'm trying to say there are reasons to prohibit this activity, but incidental means incidental. And then it absolutely excludes fundraising for any political party or campaign. So to me, that's, if you're on state travel, you should not be campaigning or fundraising as a campaign activity. And so I thought, I explained this in the State Affairs Committee. I'm trying to give an action item where we can say, beyond that action, it's unethical. Incidental is probably the only subjective language I use in here, but it gives us a bar to go over. And that means it has to be really small in comparison to the activity that you are using state travel for. That's the bar, And that can be probably the only place where I think you read motive into it, whereas the rest of the items are less subjective and more hard line action item issues. And I've tried really hard to stay there because I know the state employees under the Administration Act, they can prorate. The trouble is they're not the ones who are political in nature. They're not running for offices. They're not the ones that are making campaign speeches. They're not the one that make promises or have to go back and say, I'm fulfilling my promise, which could very well be a partisan activity. We are by nature partisan, you know, like it or not, whether I get on a campaign trail or I'm talking on a radio show that has a particular opinion, people could accuse me now of partisan political activity by just being a advocate in the area that I promised I'd be an advocate for. So if I go to Anchorage on state travel and I get called on a radio program for having an opinion, right now under the law, I might very well be charged for having partisan activity when I'm really standing up for what I believe in. And so I think we have to answer this question somewhere along the line. So I'm really searching for the answer. The criteria that I have is, if they're doing fundraising, no. If it's incidental, there's good reason for it. But the incidental has to have this categories. You don't use the state day to do that, with some exception, and that would be the lunches. And then you don't do this during a campaign day, or you don't do it if you're the campaigner 30 days prior to that campaign. So that at least puts some parameters around it. And if somebody wants to charge me with unethical behavior by using state travel, they have very clear criteria for doing that. On the other hand, it does say, hey, politician, you're a politician, whether you're elected or not. And there is a reason to believe that somewhere along the line you'll be engaged in partisan political activity. But don't misuse it. So that's the amendment, and I'd be glad to answer any questions.
Senator Coghill, I'll just say I appreciate you bringing it forward. I know it was discussed in the previous committee. The chairman's right here. It was taken out to sort of comport with longstanding sort of blanket prohibitions. But I, you know, I appreciate the thought you put into this. And I share some of your concerns. A complaint that a legislator has violated the ethics rules is a powerful complaint to level. And you should know sort of when they're coming, and you should, you know, you should always be steering to be on the very, very far side and clear side of the rules. But I've, you know, given some thought to this, and I can see that we do need to discuss it. And so I appreciate you bringing it forward. We'll discuss it a lot next year. But I'll just throw out some of the my chief of staff and I were talking about it earlier, and I know we have a great working relationship with you and your chief of staff, and we'll talk about it over the summer. You know, I've started thinking about the categories you can draw between, you know, for example, you have a large district. I have a small one. You know, we may be thinking about what sorts of things you can do when you've paid to travel inside your own district. And, you know, you're up visiting a village or whatnot, and maybe you have a, you know, maybe you make allowances for that versus being out of your own district. Whether you're doing something related to your own campaign, which should be very, very sort of strongly prohibited, or whether you're just maybe helping out someone else's. Which, you know, you may have a different set of ideas about fundraising versus not fundraising. I think we all agree that fundraising is a hot button, radioactive activity you should be steering away from, whether it's for a party or whether it's for an individual may decide, whether it's 30 days, you know, before an election or not. But I've just thought about some of the things you know could conceivably be an ethics violation under the rules as they stand now that I'm not sure should be. If you travel to Anchorage and you're there visiting Anchorage on state business, and at night in a hotel room you update your Facebook page that's related to your campaign, is that a violation? I don't know. It's you know, you can do it from anywhere in the world, but you happen to be somewhere on state business. Could you call into a radio show promoting your campaign? Could you call into a Fairbanks radio show from Anchorage promoting your campaign while on state travel to Anchorage? I don't know. I appreciate you bringing this question to us, and I'm going to be kicking it around quite a bit. Further comments from members of the committee? Senator Wilkowski.
Yeah, I appreciated the discussion in state affairs. I agree. You know, if you're traveling to Anchorage and you're you get a call from a radio station and you pick up the phone on your cell phone and you call and you're talking about partisan activities, in some ways, what does it really matter if you're in Anchorage or in Fairbanks? It's your dime. The problem is, how do you define? I mean, and that's been the problem, is how do you define where that line is? Because as you go down the line, it becomes clearly ethical. And so I think we just couldn't figure it out in state affairs how to do it in a way that you could define it and what was ethical and what was unethical. Maybe with further discussion and dialogue, there is a solution there.
Let me just put something else, Mr. Chairman, if I might. It is assumed that there will be bad actors. So I'm looking for that. I don't want to assume that everybody's a bad actor.
Right.
And so there's that. But it's also true from those who watch us. There are bad actors who watch us, as well as those who are genuinely concerned about our ethical behavior. So I don't want to give tools for bad actors to beat us up, because once we get our name in the paper under an ethical violation, that's a blot that's hard to live down. And I don't want the rules to draw that. On the other hand, I don't want legislators to take the state dime and misuse them for their own political gain. So I understand that. So there's two ways we have to look at it. First of all, how does the most noble people handle it? And that is for both sides, whether they're a politician or a citizen who really is concerned about ethical behavior in Alaska. And then on both sides, you have bad actors who might want to try to figure out how to game the system as a legislator, or how to game the system as somebody who goes after a legislator. So in watching that balance, I'm trying to think, what is the clearest rule we can get? So the closer we get to trying to define motives, the worse off we are, in my view. The closer we get to action items, the better off we are to have bright lines so that we as legislators understand what is expected of us as partisan people. And I think it really gives a hand to those who want to keep us ethically accountable for how we use state resources. And so this is the clearest way I could do that, knowing that bad actors and good actors, the noble and the less noble, are going to be on both sides of the issue. So and the Anchorage area and the Fairbanks area have some advantages, where anything outside of the highway system, well, of course, frankly, my district has the Richardson Highway, the Glen Highway, the Denali Highway, the coast from Valdez to Whittier. So I could be anywhere in those communities and totally be forbidden to go to a Republican event while having traveled, 800 miles to visit three other communities in that district. And that's painful, because I have to tell them, I can't do that. On the other hand, I just want you folks to be aware that as we stand right now, we have a exact prohibition on being partisan anytime we're on the state dime, anytime, with any partisan political activity. And that leaves us, I think, vulnerable for people who want to pick at us with bad intentions. And it makes it very difficult for us to think about everything we're doing as naturally partisan people. So right now, as the statutes have it, this is a conundrum that we've had in the Ethics Committee as we've talked about this for years and years and years. And we've had many legislators come and say, give me some relief. Tell me that I'm not unethical, because I'm not acting poorly. I'm not acting unethically, but I'm in this conundrum. And so I've really tried hard to find a way, and this amendment is my best stab at it. And as you consider it, I would ask you to consider it very seriously, because we need an answer to this question, in my view. It won't go in until next year. It goes in. It's a political year next year. So we're all revving up to redistricting, where all of us are getting shaken up, especially those of us who live in areas where we might be more rural. Or remote, even. I don't want to answer, I don't want to even out the playing field. I just want to say what is ethical and what isn't, so that everybody knows what the rules are. So thanks for letting me put the amendment forward. Mr. Chairman, if you want to hold the bill over
I could lay the amendment on the table for you guys to consider. I can remove my motion to amend. If you want to move the bill forward, I'm open to discussion, because most of the stuff in here is housekeeping issues except for this one amendment.
Senator Pascoe.
I'd make a comment, and I think this is a healthy debate, and I very much enjoy it, and I really do kind of look forward here in this committee, because I think this, as a Judiciary Committee, is a committee that's probably best suited for having this substantive discussion. But then I also want to make sure that we don't give an unfair advantage to a individual who doesn't have to travel using state money, that they can then take advantage of their personal wealth to attack someone because they have spent $100 to get to Anchorage or whatever it is, and then because they have some personal wealth that they can pick and choose when they're going to attack someone, and again, they can scam the system using their personal wealth. And so, I mean, every way you look at this can get very complex, and I think that that's another viewpoint. While the prohibition is that if you are traveling on state monies, what happens if somebody can use their economic wealth to take advantage of somebody, and knowing that they can't fight back because they were traveling on state wealth or on state monies? And so it's a complex subject, and I think we need to think it through on both sides.
Mr. Chairman, I think Senator Wilkowski has watched me on the Ethics Committee, and every once in a while I get animated, because sometimes we talk about that leveling the playing field, and I'm continually and impassioned about bringing it back to what is the ethical question, not what is the fairness question, because we're not going to solve the fairness questions, I don't think, Senator Pascoe, because because we'll go into individual liberties in a huge way if we do that. But on the state dime, we can say, here's where the line is. On your dime, sky's the limit. You know, I think it would be very difficult for us to try to regulate people under that kind of scheme. But when they're on a state dime, we have an ethical question. And right now, it says you can't be a partisan politician while you're on state travel. That's where we're at. And I think that is not reasonable, and I don't think that answers the ethical question.
Healthy debate. I think what we'll do is just leave matters as they are. The bill's in front of us, the amendment's in front of us, the objections maintained. We're going to chew on this for some time. I do think this is the right place to write some rules. I'm concerned that if we don't write them here, they may be written somewhere else. And, you know,
just
we may as well.
Last word, Mr. Chairman.
And go ahead.
Before you,
yep.
I know you'll have the last word, but my office is willing to work on this.
Yeah.
And obviously, we'll get the headlines for it somewhere along the line, probably. But I think it's something that I'm willing to work on. So my office is open to any of you who want to suggest things.
I appreciate that. Thank you, Senator Kaka. Thank you, Ms. Moss. And we'll set the bill aside. Let's turn now to biometrics, SB 98. Senator Wilkowski, what do you have for us?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Can I call my staff member, Michael Caulfield, to the table? We have CS. I don't know if / T has been adopted or not. I don't believe it has.
Well, if you'd move it.
I would move / T, as in Thomas.
For the purposes of discussion.
And if I could have Michael go through the changes, not a whole lot of changes. And I'll just say I think we've been working with many of the stakeholders here. I think it's been a real healthy dialogue. We started out at point one. There were some strong opposition, strong concerns. I think I actually think we have a piece of legislation that most people agree on. I know there are some who still have some concerns with it. We're probably not going to get to a perfect piece of legislation, but I think we've got a pretty good piece of legislation. And if I could have Michael just talk through the changes.
Yes.
Introduce yourself. Welcome.
Thank you very much. For the record, I'm Michael Caulfield, a staffer in Senator Wilkowski's office. To run through the changes, there should be a page that's in your packet that shows the changes from the last work draft we worked with, which is E, now we're to T. So the first section that we have changes on has also been the section we probably had the most questions about, which is the alternate identification. The first change was on page 2, lines 17 through 19. We've included language to clarify that occupational exams are also educational exams. That'd be exams to like the SAT or the LSAT or other exams like that. Then after that, we also have a clarification that the administrator of the exam may or require an acceptable alternate ID instead of biometrics, which is to ensure that someone cannot present like a library card and then require or and then insist that that ID be used as their ID for entrance to the exam. I understand this section still has some questions that may arise, and we may work on this a little bit more. Moving on to the next section, 1814.080, we removed the term agents of the state from the private rights of action exemption for the state. This is so a organization that the state contracts with to handle the information could still be held responsible. We want to make sure that the state is exempt, but not the organizations they contract with if they were to break the law in some way. Section 1814.085, page 3, lines 29 through 30. This was a problem that Primera had a issue with, was that when we had a ban on the recording of voices, they were worried that for quality assurance purposes, that voices, they might not be able to record that data. So, for instance, if you call into, just yesterday I called the Alaska Marine Highway, and they, you know, say, we're going to record this conversation for quality assurance purposes, and we want to ensure that they can still record those so they can go back and make sure their employees are doing a good job. We also took out a exemption for facial images in a biometric system, right, that was the fourth exemption in that list, and we took it out because we redefined what biometric data is on page 4, lines 1 and 2. We changed the term facial images to facial mapping. And then down on page 4, lines 25 through 26, we defined facial mapping as the use of digital technology to measure the features of an individual's face. This change was done to ensure, just to absolutely ensure that pictures cannot be, just pictures that are taken by anyone cannot be used or cannot be defined as biometric information. So those are the changes. I understand there might be some more issues with the alternate identification, so I will leave it there.
Mr. Caulfield, thank you for that overview. Questions for the bill sponsor or Mr. Caulfield? Let me jump in then on page 2, alternate identification. If I am administering the LSAT and I require a fingerprint, what happens if I say I just want a fingerprint?
Well, under this, how we have it written now, if you are mandating a fingerprint, they must accept another form of identification. There has been a question about when we use the term, if the individual provides, so they're a person who provides alternative identification is exempt. If they provide identification acceptable to the person administering the exam, and that could mean that the administrator says nothing else is acceptable. So we could possibly change that to clean it up and ensure that they can accept another form of identification, but that's open for interpretation. And I think there's another amendment as well, which we could introduce now also for purposes. I'm not sure. So currently, it says that they must accept an alternate form of ID that's acceptable to them.
That's what the old version said.
No, Mr. Chair, I'll clarify Senator, things. Senator Wilkowski. So the current status of version T is, and a group like LSAT, GMAT, could say we require that we would like to take your biometric information. We would anticipate that most people probably would give their biometric information, but there are some who will not. And what this says is if the person does not want to give their biometric information, the company cannot require them, provided that they provide alternate identification acceptable to the person administering the occupational examination. The way The way that I interpret that and the intent of that is exactly as Michael was saying. A library card, obviously not acceptable alternate identification. A passport or a driver's license, very clearly, I would think, acceptable alternate identification. So that's the intent of that provision.
But again, if LSAT just stands fast and says, you know what, maybe that's a U.S. passport, maybe not. I'm not a passport examiner, but I'm dang sure that's your fingerprint. What happens?
I think they're violating the law.
And
if you offer a passport or a driver's license and they look at it, I suppose they could say that's not you, but at some point you go to DMV and they could say, well, I don't believe that's your birth certificate. I mean, at some point you have to believe that that's or not. But ultimately, when you walk in right now to take an LSAT test, you got to show your ID. And if you don't have your ID or if they don't believe it's you, I'm sure they have procedures in place. So that doesn't change anything. I mean, I think right now the law is, or I'm sure they require that you provide some form of acceptable alternate identification, some form of acceptable identification.
Senator Pascoe.
You know, one of the worries that I've had is the potential that individuals that are licensed as part of a national licensing process, that the national licensing body would say, we will not allow that exam to be administered in the state of Alaska, require that Alaskans for example, the multi-state bar examination would have to go to California or Washington or some other location. CPA exam, they may have to go to some other location. I know that there are certain bodies that already do require that there are a limited number of national sites at which people can go to take a national certification. And, I think that it would be unfortunate that if by making it so restrictive that we give these national testers, for example, CPA exam or National Bar Association for lawyers, the only alternative is to leave the state of Alaska. And so in my amendment that I have drafted, that I hope that we get to soon, that I've tried to accommodate that so that the CPA people or the national law school admissions test people don't say, we're not even going to offer this exam in the state of Alaska because we want to maintain integrity of our licensing process. And so anyway, that's just my general thoughts. And at some point in time, Mr. Chair, whenever it's appropriate, I would present my amendment.
Does the amendment pertain to this section?
Yes, it does.
Okay. Senator Coghill, before we get anything to say before we get to the amendment?
Only to the word acceptable. There's a lot of words before that. It says that if they require biometrics, there needs to be another version, another way to identify them that's acceptable to them. Maybe we need to qualify that by there are so many ways right now that that we are ID'd. I don't like the driver's license being an ID, but it is. But in order to travel to Seattle now, I have to have a passport. It seems like, not Seattle, but if I, I think it is true. Now the passport is more and more required. TSA will accept it as who I am. The requirement of showing my driver's license to so many places is just clearly a regular identification, and I deplore that, but it's the truth. So do we need to maybe say generally it's acceptable to them, but we should say that is generally accepted ID, or is that too broad?
I'll leave it to the sponsor, but I was here thinking that really, I think what you're getting at is I used some form of paperwork to establish my identity in the first place.
Yeah.
Before you took my fingerprint, you said, who are you? And I said, oh, here I am. Here's my driver's license. Here's my passport. Here's my birth certificate. You said, oh, okay, you're Hollis French. Here's your fingerprint. Now, that's Hollis French's fingerprint, and we're going to use that to identify you from here on out. But you may be saying, but if when it comes time to give me the test, why can't I just use the paperwork that I used to establish my identity in the first place? Why is that suddenly no longer acceptable? I mean, you accepted that in the first place to establish who that fingerprint belonged to. Why is it no longer good to get me in and out of this test? Or
I wish I'd have said it like that, Mr. Chairman.
You helped me get there. I appreciate that. And I don't know if Senator Pasfans, and I'm not proposing an amendment because I don't have the language drafted, but let's maybe hold that thought in abeyance while we consider the amendment, because it may render our conversation unnecessary. So let's go ahead and pass it out.
Mr. Chair, I would propose Amendment 1, which is identified as T.1 or T.1 as an amendment. And
we're passing it out to members of the committee, to the secretary, to the bill sponsor, and now to interested members of the audience. As soon as we have it out, we may as well just do this conversation once. Go ahead. You want to move the amendment?
Yes, Mr. Chair. I'd move that we bring Amendment Number 1 before this committee for purposes of discussion.
Under those auspices, if you're not formally moving for its adoption, we'll discuss it. Go ahead.
Mr. Chair, the purpose of this is, again, in listening to some of the individuals, and in particular the administration of the CPA exam, is that the troubles that they've been having with individuals on the East Coast coming in, not for purposes of taking the exam, but for purposes of transferring information to the West Coast and using that time difference so that the people on the West Coast can get access to the questions hours before the test is administered on the West Coast. And as part of that, they've instituted a fingerprint, so if they know that the person before them is the singular person that is taking the test, so if they cannot use identification that may be really close. In other words, there's a lot of people that say, you know, you look at him in the street, and I said, my God, that could have been John Coghill, you know. Then you look at him a little closer, and your ID could be identical to that person's. Your passport could be effectively almost identical. Identical, but they're two different people. Anyway, the bottom line of it is that this says that if that exam taker, for example, the CPA organization, says that for the internal integrity of their national test administration and who is qualified to use the title CPA, that if they deem it legitimately necessary to require this type of information, that they will either themselves or their contract that they're working with comply with the other requirements of this bill. And I think that is, as a, so to speak, a compromise, a better solution than saying that they cannot require at all the obtaining of that information. So I'm trying to reach a compromise solution here. So for purposes of discussion, that's the starting point.
Let's hear from the bill sponsor.
We've had this discussion over the last few days. I certainly appreciate the intent of Senator Pasfan. I know his concerns are of legitimate security, and I know there are others out there who are legitimately concerned about this. I'm going to continue an objection to the amendment, but I certainly, if this comes in, I'm certainly going to support the bill as it moves forward. And I guess my basis for the objection is just, if someone walks in to take a test, then, and when I've taken tests in the past, I don't have to give a fingerprint to get in or out. But I do remember when I got up to go to the bathroom, someone actually followed me to the bathroom. And I think in Alaska, that we just got a bar review report. I think there were 70 or 80 people that take the bar exam in a year. And they're in different locations, and so you probably typically only have maybe 30 people max at a bar exam, maybe a little bit more or less. And I think if you have proctors, that's what they're there for. They will watch you, and if you leave the room, they'll literally follow you to the bathroom and stand outside the door and make sure that a different person doesn't come out of the bathroom and walk back into the test room. So I do think there are other ways to do this. I know there are people who are legitimately concerned about giving over their biometric information and have strong concerns over this, but I very much appreciate Senator Pastorn bringing this forward. I respect it. If it is approved, I'll still hope to move the bill forward. I think it's a good bill as written. It provides a lot of protections for Alaskans.
Further discussion, Senator Cockhill.
Sure. I can understand why it would be easier for them to collect your information for their security reasons. But the whole bill is the idea that you get to choose how your biometric information goes out, and it's up to them to figure out how to securitize their test. And so in the spirit of the bill, I lean in the direction of saying you have to show us why it's so important, and there's prohibitions on it and security reasons for them on the integrity of their test, I guess, would be the big deal, because that's what it sounds like. The big deal under this whole deal is the integrity of their test and the credential that they give once that credential is given. So, and I'm very sympathetic to that. But they're going to require the test taker to surrender a lot so that they could manage the integrity of their test. And I wonder if maybe they shouldn't be the ones more responsible to ensure that integrity than requiring the individual to give up so much. So that's the balancing question that I'm struggling with this. And I read this amendment, and it looked to me like a loop, because it looked like on one hand, we're going to give them the right to say what's acceptable if they don't get their fingerprint. We're going to give them the choice on what's acceptable. On the other hand, we're going to say, okay, and then you even have the right to say, hey, for the security of this test, we got to have it. And so you're actually doubling up the reasons for them to have it in some ways. At least that's what the facial appearance to me is.
Further discussion?
No, I would just move that the committee adopt Amendment T.1.
Is there objection?
I'll object, Mr. Chairman.
There's been an amendment, number one, moved before the committee. There's objection. We've heard debate. Clerk, call the roll, please.
Senator Coghill.
No.
Senator Willikowski.
No.
Senator Pastan.
Yes.
Senator French.
I'll say yes, but it doesn't matter. It's 2-2 vote. So with that, the amendment fails. That brings the bill back before us. Let's turn to the immunity section, the right of action section on page 3, section 18.14.080. This allows a private right of action to individuals for a person who violates this chapter, and I'm going to say, I guess you could violate it by collecting it where you don't have to, but more generally, I think you're penalizing people who lose biometric information. Is that the idea?
Mm-hmm. Or distribute it, yeah.
Or distribute it, right. And then the subsection B immunizes the state against any claim for damages having lost my biometric information. Maybe we can just have a short discussion about the policy rationale there.
Yeah, I'll discuss that, Mr. Chair. It's a tough call, and we initially had it written so that the state or its agents, collectors, contractors were immunized. That was taken out. We fixed that. The state had some big concerns, and the state had concerns that if through legislatively underfunding a group, they knowingly, but not with any intent to do this, somebody distributed this information and the potentially putting the state on the hook for hundreds of thousands, potentially millions of dollars of damages. That was a big concern for the state. I am sympathetic to that. I'm very wary of immunizing the state in these types of lawsuits. It was a tough call to do this. I think had we not put this section in there, there would have likely been a fiscal note attached and would have been other ramifications from that, which would have made it, I think, a lot more difficult to get the bill passed, with the concern that the state could be on the hook for quite a bit of money. The state is not, it would still be illegal for the state to disclose this information. We're just, someone could file an action to bar them if the state decided to do this. They just can't sue for damages. It's a policy call. I think the bill as a whole is a good bill. I think it moves Alaska way forward on protecting people's privacy, but it was just a policy call that was made to try to expedite the bill and make a large incremental change to get it passed.
Senator Lukowski, I am fairly confident that you are no great fan of immunity provisions. I think that's probably been established in the record in many other places. I share your concern. On the other hand, it may be that you're just sort of taking instead of taking two big steps forward, you're taking one step forward, and you can circle back around on this provision in the future. Further discussion. Senator Pascoe.
You know, I don't know that there's been any lawsuits against the state in this area. And the question fundamentally is under 950-250, which is the state's statute as to when it is or is not liable, that would be the status of where we are at if there was nothing here. And so I guess I'm concerned that we're providing immunity no matter how egregious the conduct on behalf of the state, I think for possibly insufficient reasons, and certainly this is going to be a growing area where the state is going to be assembling, I assume, this type of information in the decades and decades to come, and I just think that it's problematic to give absolute immunity.
Let me strengthen my understanding. Let's go back to page 2, section 18.14.020 on line 3. It says a collector may not disclose, transfer, or distribute biometric information. The penalties for that are contained in section 080.
Yes.
Is that right?
Yes.
It's not a criminal violation. It's a civil violation, and you get financially penalized.
Yes.
Okay. And for the purpose of discussion, what if a bad apple intentionally sells a state employee intentionally sells doesn't lose my information by putting down a laptop or doesn't leave it in his car or something, but intentionally sells my biometric information, is that state employee immunized?
If they were in the role of their state as a state agent of the state, then yes, they would.
I think, Mr. Chair, I think if they were acting in their duties as a state employee, they would be. I think if they acted outside of their state duties, they would.
It's questionable whether they're right. Right. In which case, they could be on the hook for $100,000. Further questions?
On page 3, line 17, it says damages, penalty, or both are essentially absolutely waived.
And Mr. Chair, if I could, it's for violations of this chapter. So, and for other claims arising under this chapter. So, I'm sure there are creative lawyers who could figure out other violations outside of this chapter for an employee who did something like that. I suspect.
Yeah.
It's my perception that the immunity is broad.
Well, and I think the language is the language. The way I read this is an action for damages or penalty or both may not be brought for violations of this chapter or other claims arising under this chapter. If there were some common law claim or some other tort claim or some other claim under another statute, then I don't think it's certainly not our intent to ban those.
Well, let's put it in perspective. It's the state's been collecting fingerprints for since it was a state. I don't know if they've ever been sold to anybody. I don't know if there really is a brisk market for fingerprints. I think there's concern out there that it may become more prevalent in the future, but I think the general concern is aimed at private enterprise and their collection of the material and not state collection, I mean, in all fairness. I had concerns about here, I guess, you know, I was posing probably the most bizarre hypothetical I could imagine. So, I don't love that provision, it's not the end of the world. Further committee discussion?
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Wilkowski.
I've heard representative from your district in Spinard say on many occasions, don't let the perfect get in the way of the good. It's not a perfect bill. It doesn't go as far as I'd like, but as you said, it's instead of maybe two steps forward, maybe one step forward. And just on the issue that was raised by Senator Coghill, page 2, line 16, there was a question raised about, and I think you raised it as well, what identification acceptable to the person. And I just crafted some language, which I think everyone would probably be okay with, and that is page 16, information, I'll read the sentence. If a person who administers an occupational examination requires an individual taking the examination to provide biometric information to the person for the purpose of identifying the individual taking the examination, the person may not require that the individual provide biometric information if the individual provides, and here would be the change. If the individual provides generally accepted alternate identification to the person administering the occupational examination. I don't think that's a substantive change. I think that gets at really what the intent is, but it states it maybe in a little clearer way.
Why don't we take a short at ease while you write that on a piece of paper. We're back on the record. I think we have put the amendment aside. So there's no amendment before the committee. We've been discussing backslash T. I think the sponsor's been clear. And I noticed there are two other co-sponsors of this legislation here in the committee, but I'm not one.
Still open for co-sponsorship.
Yeah. In a different forum. What's the will of the committee? Senator Wilkowski.
Mr. Chair, I would move that we move, and I'll just say we've done a lot of work on this bill. I think it's a much improved bill. It's not perfect, as I've mentioned. I think it's a good bill. I think it moves us forward in the area of protecting Alaskans' privacy. So I'd move CS for Senate Bill 98 /T onto the next committee with individual recommendations and accompanying fiscal note.
Is there objection? Hearing and seeing none, bill's moved. We'll take a short at ease for the paperwork. We're back on the record to SB 104. Senator Coghill, don't feel bad about your bill staying in committee, because I think this one is going to as well. But I do want to get some concerns on the record, and we never have had sort of an in-depth examination of the bill. It is SB 104. If I've got a legislative staffer to come forward, Mr. Motoro, welcome to the committee. We have made some changes since the bill was last before the committee. We'll walk through those. We'll get some questions and then go from there. So if there could be a motion to adopt /D as our working document.
So moved.
I'll object for the purposes of discussion. Mr. Motoro, welcome.
Thank you, Chair French, members of the committee. For the record, Andy Motoro, staff to Senator French. Along with the CS, you should have received a memo describing the changes to the bill. Starting first in Section 27 on page 20, we modified the legislation to respond to feedback we received from DNR's recorder's office. Under 4017-125A, we modified it so that the recorder's office won't have to determine whether an affidavit under the bill meets the requirements of 3485 under the legislation. That's the part of the bill that relates to how a manufactured home is affixed to real property. The recorder's office doesn't traditionally do this with documents. In fact, there's a statute that says that they don't make those judgments about the bill other than simple whether it complies with the application. And they're online if there's any specific questions on that one change.
We do have just, let me interrupt you just for a second, Mr. Motoro. We do have Whitney Brewster from DMV, Vicki Bacchus from the State Records Office, and Jeff Harris from Wells Fargo, and Pat Green from Wells Fargo for questions from the committee.
Excellent.
Please continue.
Section 4017-125B had very minor changes. Recorders no longer write on records. They affix barcodes when things are changed. So we put place to replace the word write. And we also modified land record to public record to match where they record these changes. Subsection C of that was removed just because it's not traditional for the recorder's office to automatically send certified copies of these affidavits. Instead, people have to request them. And that last change created some conforming changes in other sections of the bill. You'll see those on page 2 of the memo, 3485-06012, 3485-127, and then 2 and 2810, which made reference to those areas. Another area that we changed was section 16 of the legislation. The bill had it so that a primary lien holder would be notified of conversion.
Just hold on 1 second, Mr. Motoro. What page is section 16 on?
I believe it's page 10. That's at a...
I am on page 10.
Page 6, excuse
page
me.
Page 6.
Yes. Sorry about that.
Very good. Hold on. Section 16. Yep, begins at the bottom of page 6. Thank you.
Yes. And the original draft required DMV to notify a primary lien holder of completed conversions in instances when the conversion involved canceling an MCO, Manufacturer Certificate of Origin, or a title. But under this section, under 2810-267, there would never be a primary lien holder during the conversion process because all liens must be cleared before before the conversion can take place. So to change that up and to allow notice to an interested party, we instead inserted, instead of primary lien holder, we allowed the applicant to name someone else to receive a copy of the application having been processed. And in order to make that change, 2810-262C was changed, 263C was changed, 264D, and then 2810-265C as well. The person will be named under 2810-266-12. And that's a very brief summary of the changes.
Any questions for Mr. Motoro? I think you're ready for your real estate license examination, Mr. Motoro.
Thank you.
Thank you. I know Senator Pascrane had some questions. Senator Pascrane.
Just with respect to page 15, lines 14 through 20, and what I'm trying to ascertain is what does the park owner, the lessor, the real property consent to, and what interest in real property, if any, does the lessor of the park give up or have subject to the real estate laws?
Senator
Murrow, do you have any answer?
Well, Senator Paxman, through the chair, I was going to ask and see if someone from the banking industry can answer that question.
Yes.
We have two representatives from Wells Fargo on the line. Did you hear the question, or do you need it restated? And when you answer, just put yourself on the record. Let us know who's speaking.
Mr. Chairman, this is Pat Green with Wells Fargo, and unfortunately, we're not able to have George Ginsburg with us today. He's our Wells Fargo outside counsel that had his that had the biggest part in drafting the bill. For the most part, this piece of legislation is intended for those type of manufactured homeowners that also own the land underneath it. I'm not sure if Jeff Harris, who's with our Wells Fargo Home Mortgage Manufactured Housing Division, can answer the question better than I.
Thank you, Mr. Green. Mr. Harris, did you hear the question, and can you shed a little light on what it is that the lessor, the trailer park owner, so to speak, is consenting to on page 15, line 20 of the bill?
Mr. Chairman, would it be possible to have the question stated once more?
Sure. We're on page 15 of the bill, line 20, and the issue is a manufactured home or a trailer on not on property that the trailer owner owns, but on property that a trailer park lessor owns. It's a big trailer park. There's 50 trailers or 1,000, and the trailer owner wants to convert to this new form of real property ownership, and it says that he or she can do that as long as there's a lease in recordable form that has a term for 20 years, and the lessor of the real property consents. Does that mean that the lessor, the trailer park owner, has a veto over the mobile homeowner's option to switch over to real property?
Yeah, I'll answer that the best I can. If an individual had a home in a park, they would have to move that home onto their own piece of land, and then they could affix it and go through the procedure and they get a fee simple transaction and get a mortgage on their home then. If it's in a park and it's owned by the park owner, a lender would not be able to lend on that because they would have a lease with that park owner, and the park owner owns the land. What's required is that the individual customer needs to own the land and the home together, and then we could put a mortgage on it and then be a fee simple transaction.
Okay, but just to get to Senator Pascrane's question, or at least as I understand it, there are some instances, it looks to me, under the bill in which a mobile home owner in a park can go through the process, and that's if you've got a 20-year lease, which is extremely unusual, and the park owner consents. Is that the way you read that?
Yeah, unfortunately George isn't on the phone, but he does have that provision, if it's a 20-year lease, which is a long-term lease, then we're giving an option to the lender then to agree to lend to the customer on that home, on that transaction, because it is a long-term lease and there is less risk. So that option is put into the legislation.
Sure. Further questions, Senator Pascan?
Sure. You know, in a typical real estate transaction and a residential loan, if the lending institution institutes a default procedure, they will institute a non-judicial foreclosure as compared to a judicial foreclosure. Do you expect the same process to be followed with respect to this type of transaction? And kind of in a couple-step process, I assume then that the note is going to be rewritten, a deed of trust, and would be effectuated, and would under the real estate laws, a deficiency judgment be prohibited, assuming the non-judicial foreclosure.
Senator Pasvan, through the chair, this is Pat Green with Wells Fargo. Yes, again, trying to do our best we can to answer the question without George Ginsburg, our outside counsel, available. But, yes, that's my understanding that all the normal foreclosure procedures, if the loan should default, being as it's turned into real property, would be followed in just the same manner.
Yeah, this is Jeff. Mr. Chairman, and Pat is correct. The foreclosure procedures would be the same as a stick-built home.
I think I heard you say the foreclosure proceedings would be the same as for a normal home.
Correct, yeah.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Harris. Further questions from Senator Pascan?
Not at this time.
Not this time. Okay, with that, we have come to 3 o'clock, and we're going to hold this bill over. This may very well be the last meeting of the Judiciary Committee for this year. I appreciate everyone's hard work. I'm sorry Senator Coghill isn't here, but he can watch it on TV when he comes back from the break. And with that, we are adjourned.